All right, so forgive me for not being quite as prepared. When you feel a little bit discombobulated, you know, there's this urge, I don't know if you ever feel it, probably do, is you want things to go really well. You want it to be impressive, you want people to like it, you want them, and there's a real tendency and a temptation in churches and in all sorts of other organizations is to try to entertain people. Make sure they walk out happy, like, hey, I got entertained. And after a while, that's such a trap, right, to entertain people. But it's so tempting, just so you know, in the Christian world, in church world, of which I still feel like a strange person in the church world. I didn't grow up in a church at all. We went just a little bit, and when it got kind of weird, I asked my parents if we could stop going, and we stopped going to church. It was never really a part of my life. It felt kind of a foreign world to me. But you're tempted to kind of entertain. And I was reminded this week in Zechariah, who is a prophet during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, that he said, "It is not by might nor by power." Now, those two words, one represents individual skill and ability. It's not by might, he says. It's not by an individual's charismatic, powerful way to entertain, move people, be impressive, blah, 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 whatever, right? It's not by might, nor by power. And that word in Hebrew means a corporate power. The ability in a corporate way to have this big movement, this big whatever, it's not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord God. One of the most disturbing things I read this week was when it quoted a Christian leader from centuries past who said, "The saddest thing in the world is that what we do in the church is about the best that human flesh can do and never reflects the Spirit of God." And I thought, oh, wow. If I stand in line in heaven and the Lord says, "Kevin, thank you for you showed up every week, but it simply was what the flesh could produce, and it wasn't about my spirit," that it will be the most painful thing I'd ever heard. And let's just be honest, so often it's easy to do the life in the flesh. Do it in our own power, do it in corporate power, and never depend on the Spirit of God. The Spirit of God is not necessary to do what we do. I mean, that's kind of the temptation, right? But it actually is necessary. And so when we say, you know what, it's not about me, it's about Him. Now, that doesn't mean we want to do a crummy job and forget to put my microphone on. And, you know, it doesn't mean that we excuse ourselves from not doing a good job, but at the end of the day, it's got to be the Spirit of God that moves the heart of men and women, of young people. And we live in a nation and in a time and a history where the Spirit of God has been relegated and kind of thrown to the side. And I think we just have to really come back to the Spirit of God, that He will do what He wants to do. So today, I pray that that's what happens, that the Spirit of God, can I get out of the way? Can we all get out of the way in a sense? And really let God's Spirit work in our lives. So that's my prayer, okay? And I think yours too. All right, so let's jump in. You guys, we're trying to wrap up today this series called Rebuild, a study of Ezra and Nehemiah, but it's also going to be a part of the new series that's called A Series with Heart, okay? So it's kind of, we mixed the screen up today a little bit and to say that's what we want to do. So I want to wrap it up, and then I want to move on. But so in this Ezra and Nehemiah, here's our chronology of the Old Testament. Just remember, okay? So down here, 500 years before the coming of Christ is the person of Ezra and Nehemiah, these books and what they're recording. Now that's 500 years after David's life, which is 500 years after Moses' life, which is 500 years after Abraham's life. So just to kind of get a feel for it, right? And you go, oh, okay. So these are the last recorded historical books of the Old Testament before the coming of Jesus, because after these, we get these 400 silent years where there's no one sent, no prophet sent to communicate, and no historical, at least in the Old Testament. Now, there's history there. There are things that had happened. Some of those you can find in the Apocrypha. Others you can find in just history books of what was going on. Because right in between those 400 years, right in the middle of it is called the Greek Empire. That's no small thing, right? It came racing through. But we have Ezra and Nehemiah, and we've been looking at what they're doing. Now, here's a chart that's a little more complete, if you will, with all the different things from Abraham to the time of Jesus. Now, we won't go through all the pieces here today, but just to see all these things that were going on. But we're talking about this time of rebuilding Jerusalem, rebuilding the nation of Israel, which at this point is not the 12 tribes of Israel. It's only two. It's Judah and Benjamin. They're the only ones left. The other 10 have been captured by Assyria and scattered to the winds. We've never found them since. One of the most incredible and tragic things in all of history is the losing of these 10 tribes of Israel. Now, Jesus is going to bring them back. They're going to come back together as time, history kind of comes to a close here. But this is a time of rebuilding because they'd been sent into exile because of their disobedience to God. And God, it says Nebuchadnezzar took them, but he didn't really take them. It was God who did it. And he took them into exile to get their attention. And there are all sorts of things that happen in this and people speaking, one of which we're going to touch on today. Because here's the chronology of what we've been talking about. The return under Zerubbabel, the return under Ezra, and the return under Nehemiah. And later this morning, I'm going to touch on the prophet Haggai. You go, really? Haggai? It's kind of a weird one, isn't it? It's a real small book. It's only two chapters long. We don't talk about Haggai all that much. Can it really be all that cool? And there's something in the second chapter that I think is profound that will be about a series with heart because it's one of the chapters that just grabbed me like a vice and shook me. So we're going to get there. So before we do that, though, let me ask a question. What did you learn while looking at Ezra and Nehemiah over the last 3 months? What did you learn? And maybe if I want to risk it, I'll ask you that question and have you answer. But for right now, I asked myself that question. What did I learn? And so I thought, well, okay, as I prepare for this message, let me start, kind of go back through all the sermons and maybe look back through all my commentaries and look at all the summaries and say, okay, what did they say? And then I thought, no, wait a second. What did he teach me? What do I remember? What hit me? Without trying to go back and fill it all in. What hit me? What did I remember? And so I'd ask you the same question. What do you remember from the last 3 months? Or did it just kind of pass by really quickly? So you guys, here are the things that hit me. I hope they hit you. First of all, discipline is always aimed at producing growth and redemption. God's discipline. God does punish, but God also disciplines. It's different. And when God disciplines, it's with a purpose of growing us and redeeming us. God's discipline is because he loves us. Just like a parent who disciplines their children, they do it because they care. They don't want this kid to live a life of chaos and craziness and to end up in life without direction, without meaning, and without being built in their character. That's why we discipline our kids. Is discipline fun? I don't know about you, but I never really enjoyed it that much. You know, I didn't enjoy being disciplined, and I actually didn't enjoy disciplining my kids all that much. It was hard. You know, when they think you're kind of a knucklehead, you're like, I don't like being told I'm a knucklehead, or at least they, like, I don't like you. I don't know if you've ever done that as a parent, you know, when you discipline your kids, and they go, I don't like you. And you go, well, that's a bummer. I want to be liked. But more than that, I want to love you. And I'm unwilling for you to be without direction, without curbs in life. So discipline is always aimed at producing growth and redemption. The second thing I remembered learning was each and every individual has value in themselves and also in the community. Each and every individual has value. You mean during Ezra and Nehemiah, they listed names over and over, chapters worth of names, people, families, clans, villages, the whole nine yards. Everyone's name mattered. Most of those names were hard to pronounce. That's why I usually skipped them. You know, they're just difficult, especially for someone who doesn't phonetically read very well. I was like, well, whatever, you know, let's just kind of go through. I just wanted to call them, you know, Tom and Sally, you know, kind of thing. But every individual matters. So when I think about that, I think about us, that every person in this room matters. The role they play, who they are, all that they're about, the uniqueness of them. Every individual matters. If you were the last human being on planet Earth, God would say, you matter to me. I know everything about you. I think, wow. And so often in life, it's so easy to just kind of go through and forget the individual, not see them, hear them, pay attention, stop, and be about the individual. And every individual matters in the community. And then the next thing I learned is the importance of the community is often understated and usually misunderstood. The importance of community. You got over and over again in Ezra and Nehemiah, they individually were involved, but they were individually involved with a group of people, and they were side by side, shoulder by shoulder, doing the work, and the community got it done more than any individual could ever do, right? They needed each other. They needed to be together. And we had people working on the wall who were perfumers, that were jewelry makers. They weren't wall builders, but they're like, you know what? We're in this thing together. We got to do it together. We're a community of people. Everyone's important, but togetherness is important, the unity. So every piece of in the New Testament, it talks about every piece of the body is important. But every piece is important also because when you connect it, the body functions really well when all the pieces are connected. When pieces aren't connected, things don't work that great, right? You know, like I have two hip replacements, and if they were to just do the first part of the surgery and just cut your leg off, which feels like what they do. They go and they just literally saw your leg. And then they take this titanium spike and they hammer it down into your femur, you know. Like, wow, that's kind of nasty, you know. It's kind of brutal. It's a little, but you got to have it all connect, right? When you break something, and sometimes people have to have surgically things put back together, it's because it belongs together. It needs to be unified. And so the community is really, really important. We live in a time where division is the spirit of our day, right? Anarchy is the spirit of our day. And it works exactly against, it's tearing things and people apart. And it is so anti what God is all about, wanting to build us and put us together. Wow. Here's another thing I learned. There is a tremendous need for effective leadership in the rebuild process. Zerubbabel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and others. Remember how many times Nehemiah said, and I selected capable leaders to do this. Effective leadership is really important. Now, no one's perfect, right? There's no perfect leader. So let's get that out of our minds. But people who are willing to lead and step up and help and involve others and coordinate others and get others involved and to give leadership. It's really important in this rebuild process. Another thing I learned is this. It is profoundly important and logically consistent to acknowledge the glory of God. You know, sometimes we get going so fast in life and we become a man-centered culture. A man-centered theology. And we forget that it is really important and it's so logical to acknowledge the awesomeness of God. You know, the purpose statement of Quest is this. It is to glorify God by making disciples. But the first part of it is the most important part. It is to glorify God. You know, to glorify God means to reveal him, to expose him for who he actually is. It has been veiled in our culture, in our nation, among our people. It has been veiled who God really is. We've covered it up and we've hidden it because we've taken man and put him in front and said, this is what life's all about, is about man. Now, man is important, right? Of course. God created us for a purpose. but to glorify him is our purpose. So what it means is, this is how I picture it, to reveal him and to expose him means that with everything that we say and everything that we do, that we would take the curtain that hides him and we would pull it back and we'd say, oh my gosh, look who he is. He is beautiful. He is majestic. He is awesome. He is merciful. He is kind. He is huge. And we just keep going. Throw out some other words. If we pull back the veil and here's who God really, really is, what is he like? You guys, throw out some words. He's faithful to the core. Wow. I'm sorry, he's right here? He is wonderful in everything he's done, okay? He is generous. He is love. He is mighty. He is holy, without blemish in every way. And so often we veil who God is, and we need to pull it back, right? And the glory of God, and isn't that what they were doing? Anybody sitting on a tack and wants to say another thing about God? Creative. Just look around and see how creative he is. He's personal and he meets you in the midst of life this week. He is sovereign. Absolutely. Faithful to himself. Compassionate. Okay, we could go probably for a couple of weeks here just talking about, but that it is so important and it is so logical to acknowledge the glory of God, to pull back the veil. And reveal by what we say and what we do in life. Right? So, and God is so great. So yesterday, I'm at Costco getting gas. I don't know how it happened, but I locked my keys and my phone in my car. I don't know. I must have hit the button on the way out. I don't know. And I'm just like, want to spit bullets, right? I mean, I'm just like, this is really irritating. And then I can't get a hold of my family because I don't know their number. It's in my phone. It's crazy. You know, so I say, hey, can I borrow your phone? And I dial Diane's number and it's like, won't go through. And I'm like, and so then I call the police and they come and they try to get it open. They can't get it open. You know, it's like, oh my gosh. And so they said, well, maybe you can go inside because you have your card with you. I did have my wallet, thank goodness. And I can go inside and they'll have your wife's real number. I want to say, shut up, you know, but so I go inside and sure enough, I had the wrong number in my head and I get her real number and I call her and I say, okay, I locked my keys and my phone in the car and da-da-da-da-da. So graciously she came and gets me in my car. But the guy at the gas station, he goes, wow, you were so calm, cool, and collected. What was that all about? And I was like, you didn't see on the inside. On the inside, I wanted to just totally say what I thought about life, you know? But if I were to say what I thought about life, who's to blame? I'm the one who locked it in there. I'm the idiot, you know, I'm the knucklehead who locked the stinking thing in there. And I'm like, I don't know if you saw that I was calm, cool, and collected, but if you did, it was purely the Spirit of God on the outside, though on the inside I was struggling. But we need to honor him, right? Okay, here's another thing I learned. Anything done for the glory of God and the good of mankind can and will inevitably face opposition, right? It will. And in this particular thing, in Ezra and Nehemiah, who were they? Sanballat and Tobiah. They're nasty dudes. And then Nehemiah goes back to Babylon for a couple of years, and while he's gone, they sneak themselves into the temple, take over, take up residence. He had to come back and kick them out. And he did it strongly. There's going to be opposition to things in life. I don't know about you, but I hate that part. Like, when could we get past this part? That there's things going to be hard. Things aren't going to go right. There's going to be opposition. People are going to strike back. People are going to oppose. I don't know about you, but I don't really love that part of life. But it's reality. And if I think it's not going to be reality, I'm a fool. I'm crazy. I'm out of my mind. It's going to happen. there's going to be opposition. In this world, Jesus said, you have tribulation, but take courage, for I've overcome the world. But we want the last part. We don't like the first part. You know, let's do the tribulation away, please. But doesn't work that way. How about this one? God's faithfulness is the cornerstone of a life that produces useful, fruitful, and stable people. God's faithfulness. He'll meet you where you're at. In the midst of all of it. We have people in here that are headed for university again in just a month or so. There are going to be all sorts of challenges and difficulties. And God's faithfulness to you. Kathy, God's faithfulness to you in losing Ron. And hopefully the people of God and their faithfulness. The faithfulness to the things that you're going through. God's faithfulness is the cornerstone to produce in us a usefulness and a fruitfulness and a stability. How about this one? There is a profound need for the redeeming of the soul of mankind. If there's been anything that we've seen in the last couple of years, and we see in Ezra and Nehemiah, there is a tremendous need for the redeeming of the soul of man. We live in a tumultuous, crazy, upside-down, inside-out world, and there's a huge need. And I was just telling Nelson, our police officer, this morning, I get these readouts on my phone from St. Louis County Police Department, and it almost become callous to day after day after day after day, usually several times, a call for homicide, suicide, overdose, on and on and on and on, and it just makes you almost callous. But the huge need for the redeeming of man, of man's soul. Where is it going to come from? How's it going to happen? And I think that's what we're dealing with here. Here's the last thing I'm going to throw out. Ezra and Nehemiah, that I learned, is the redemptive work of God is centered on the work of Christ on the cross. You might say, really? I didn't see that in there. You know, I know it's going to get there, but I didn't see that in there. Here's what I'd like to look at today real quickly. And this is kind of the series with heart part. I want to look at Haggai chapter 2. Okay? So here it is. It says, in the seventh month. Now, let me put this. Haggai is a prophet who is speaking to the people of Israel. And it's primarily during the time of Zerubbabel, during the time of rebuilding the temple. Okay? So it wasn't later. There were several prophets, including Zechariah and Malachi, but also Haggai, who spoke along with Ezra and Nehemiah to the people of Israel. So here's Haggai. It says, in the seventh month, this is the month of Tishrei. If you guys remember, this is a really critical month in the Jewish calendar. The Day of Atonement, the Festival of Booths. I got to be really careful saying that word. the Festival of Tabernacles is maybe a better way to put it. Is during this time, in the seventh month, on the 21st day of the month, the word of the Lord came by the hand of Haggai the prophet. And here's what it says, what God says through Haggai. Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel. This is the political leader of his day in Israel, the governor of Judah. And to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, who is the high priest, the religious leader of his day. So he's saying, speak to them. Speak to the political leader, speak to the religious leader. And then, and to all the remnant of the people. He says, no, just don't speak to everyone, okay? The religious leader, the political leader, and everybody, speak to them. And say this, who is left among you who saw this house in its former glory? Three questions here. How do you see it now? Is it as nothing in your eyes? You guys, we don't know for sure, but probably we think that Haggai was probably elderly when this happened. He had probably seen Solomon's temple before it was destroyed by the Babylonians. He saw it. It was an incredible building. It was fabulous. It was amazing. It was this fabulous place for the nation of Israel to rally around and to worship God together. It was this incredible place, and what they're rebuilding evidently didn't have much impressiveness to it. And he says to them, who's left? Maybe you've seen it or maybe you've heard about it. What do you see now? Is it nothing in your eyes? The rhetorical answer is yes, it seems like nothing. It's so not cool. Let's go to verse 4. So Haggai says this, yet now, in the midst of this disappointment, in the midst of what doesn't seem as cool as what used to be, look at this, what he says to Zerubbabel. He says, be strong. Be courageous. Don't give up. Don't quit. Hang in there. Be strong. O Zerubbabel, declares the Lord. Look at this. Be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Be strong. Be courageous. Don't quit. Don't give in. Something bigger is happening here that you do not understand. Hang in there. In the difficulty, stand up. And then look at this. Be strong. Highlight it. All you people of the land, declares the Lord. Not just your leaders, but your people. You guys, I don't know if there could be anything more apropos to our day. In a nation that feels like it's being turned inside out and upside down, where there is radical change that's happening and we don't know where exactly it's going to land, he says, be strong. Be courageous. Don't give up. Don't lay down. Don't quit. Hang in there. Be courageous. Be strong. Wow. And then look at this at the end of verse 4. Let's highlight it. Work. Do the work. Yeah, it's maybe not going to be Solomon's temple. But it doesn't matter how fancy it is. It is a fact that we are going to rebuild the temple and worship God together. Do the work. And there's going to be more work to be done, right? Eventually, 60 years later, they're going to rebuild the wall. That's going to be a lot of work. But he says, work. And why would we do that? Look at this. Let's highlight it. Let's underline it. For I am with you. I am with you. God, it seems dark. It seems hard. It seems like we're losing. This isn't as great as I was hoping it would be. He goes, that's all right. I'm with you. I am with you. It is not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord in Zechariah, right? I'm with you. Declares, look at this, the Lord of hosts. Hosts means this. It is the armies of heaven. It is the angelic armies of heaven. I am with you, the one who is over all of the universe, the one who is the commander of all the armies. In the heavenly army, it will make your armies look like nothing. I am with you. Now look at this. According to the covenant that I made with you when you came out of Egypt. So you got to ask the question, well, what covenant was that? I mean, if it's according to that, what is that covenant, right? Well, let's look at this. In Exodus, out of the Pentateuch, out of the Torah, it says this, Exodus 29. There I will meet with the people of Israel. This is God calling his people together. And it shall be sanctified by my glory. This is his tabernacle that he's building. And it says, and I will consecrate the tent of meetings and the altar, and Aaron also and his sons, and I will consecrate to serve me as priests. And then look at this, highlight it. I will dwell among the people of Israel and will be their God. I will be with you. Right? And they shall know that I am the Lord their God, who brought them out of the land of Egypt that I might dwell among them. I am the Lord their God. You guys, in the nation today, it is not required that Christians be the dominant force for God to work. What is required for him to work is he says, I'll be with you. I'm going to be with you. My spirit will fill you. Just walk with me. And I want to touch a world through you. Maybe as a country declines, I don't know for sure. But if it does, it does. And God will not be handicapped by it. He would like to work simply in us, his spirit to fill us. Wow. That is his covenant. It is the covenant that God made with Moses, that I will be with you. I will be your God, and you will be my people. Wow, that's powerful. My spirit remains in your midst. Wow. And then look at this. The third thing that he says in verse 5 to do is to fear not. Don't be afraid. Don't live in fear. And that doesn't mean to not be concerned and logical about a disease. What he's talking about here is not being fearful of a culture that's sliding away. Because God isn't sliding away. He said, man, I'm with you, and I'll stay with you. You don't have to be fancy. You don't have to entertain. You don't have to look all cool. All you want to do is walk with me, and I'm going to walk with you, and I'm going to be with you. Wow. Look in verse 6. For thus says the Lord of hosts, yet once more in a little while I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land. He's forecasting here. He's prophesying something here. He goes, in a little while. It doesn't mean like in a little while, like in a day or two. It means somewhere assuredly down the road, I am going to shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land. They're like, what? You're going to shake it? You guys, when it's shaking in the scriptures, it always has to do with the power of God. All right? You guys, real quickly, let me just kind of touch on this. As it is, at some point, there was going to be more things happening. Look at this during the crucifixion. You guys, just remember this. From the sixth hour, there was darkness over all the land during the ninth hour. This is from noon until 3. And about the ninth hour, 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani. That is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of the bystanders hearing it said, this man is calling Elijah. And one of them at once ran and took a sponge and filled it with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink. And the others said, wait, let's see whether Elijah will come and save him, because they anticipated the coming of Elijah again in a saving kind of way. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. And behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook, and the rocks split. And the tombs were all open, and many bodies of the saints who had all fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, that they went into the holy city and appeared to many. And when the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake that took place, they were filled with awe, and they said, truly, this is the Son of God. I think this is what Haggai's talking about. The coming of shaking of the earth. There's going to be this radical thing that happens. And it shook. You guys, not just during the crucifixion. Look at this during the resurrection. It says, after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake. For an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. And his appearance was like lightning, and his clothing was like snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the woman, do not be afraid. For I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He is risen. The most important event in all of human history. He is risen. The earth quaked, and he is risen. Wow. Look at you guys. Eventually, it's going to shake again down the road. This is when Jesus returns to earth. This is Matthew 24. Jesus was teaching about the things that would happen at the return, his second coming. He says, immediately after the tribulation, 7 years of tremendous tribulation on the earth, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of heavens will be shaken with power and they will appear in heaven and the signs of the Son of Man. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels and a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds and from the end of heaven to the, from one end of heaven to the other. Wow. This is the coming. Look at this. When Jesus returns, there's going to be this thing called the Battle of Armageddon, which will be an incredible battle. Look at this. Behold, the day is coming for the Lord, when the spoil taken from you will be divided in your midst, and I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be taken, and the houses plundered, and the women raped. Half of the city will go out into exile, but the rest of the people shall not be cut off from the city. And then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations, as when he fights on a day of battle. And on that day his feet shall stand on the Mount of Olives. that lies before Jerusalem to the east. And the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east and west with a very wide valley, so that one half of the mountain shall move northward and the other half southward. There will be this incredible earthquake. And the reality at the Mount of Olives will be split in half in the coming of Christ through the eastern gate to take his rightful position in the temple in Jerusalem. Wow. You guys look at verse 7. And I will shake all nations, and so that the treasures of all nations shall come in, and I will fill the house with glory, says the Lord of hosts. At some latter point, I'm going to fill this house with glory. And it's going to be the coming of Christ. The silver is mine, the gold is mine, declares the Lord. And the latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former. You think you've seen something in Solomon's temple? You've seen nothing yet. Because the coming of Christ, as he takes millennial reign in that temple, will put this all to shame. And look at this. And in this place, I will give peace, declares the Lord of hosts. Wow. You guys, let me just read one last passage out of John chapter 2. It says, the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And in the temple, he found that those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip of cords, he drove them out of the temple. This isn't what the temple's for, he says. What have you done? You've turned this into a house of robbers. You've turned it into a marketplace. What are you doing? With the sheep and the oxen, he poured out the coins and the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. And so the Jews said to him, what sign do you show us for doing these things? And Jesus answered, look at this, you guys, it's powerful. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And they're like, what? Look at this, in fact. The Jews said, are you kidding? It's taken 46 years to rebuild this temple. Now, you guys, this temple that had been built, this was simply an add-on to what Zerubbabel had built when he redid the temple. Herod came along and kind of updated it, if you will, and made it incredible. It's called the Second Temple. And he'd been doing it, and Herod had been doing it for 46 years. He goes, are you kidding? You're going to redo this thing in 3 days? And you're going to raise it up in 3 days? But verse 21, but he was speaking about the temple of his body. When, therefore, he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture in the word that Jesus had spoken. You see, the temple is the place where the divine and the human meet. You see, Jesus is the temple. He is the exact integration of humanity and divinity in perfect form. And it's in him that you and I, as human, meet the divine. It's in the person of Christ. This is the latter glory that Haggai was talking about. The former glory of Solomon's temple is nothing compared to this. This is where Jesus will reign in the temple millennially for 1,000 years after he returns. Wow. So what do we do with this? I'd just like to make this statement. To worship is to understand and to celebrate the crucifixion and the resurrection of the one who actually is the temple of God, the place where the divinity and humanity meet. And that's the incredible thing that we get to do this morning. So let me just ask a few more questions. Have you surrendered your life to Christ? If that's the latter glory, the person of Christ, no one has ever been like him. No one will ever be again. He is the one who is divine, who came in human form to die for you and for me. Have you surrendered your life to him? It's a pretty basic deal. Let me just ask, maybe this is the first time today. Maybe you've never done it before. Maybe, you know what, I've been kind of sitting on this. I've been waiting. I've been kind of filling my life with myself. And I finally come to the end of my road. It is a dead end. I'm tired of it. And I need him. Maybe for the very first time. Or maybe this one. Maybe it's for the millionth time. Maybe you're at a place where you say, you know what? I have walked apart from God. I've filled my life with things I shouldn't have. And I need to confess it. I need to come back. Jesus says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him, and he with me. We'll have that relationship. It's written to the church in Ephesus. Behold, I stand at the door. If you hear God's knocking today in your life and saying, hey, you've kind of been on a prodigal road. I want to call you home. I want to call you back. I want to call you here. And for us to then take communion together is to be able to say, I recognize that he gave his body for me. He gave his blood for me. And whether it's for the very first time or maybe the millionth time, you say, Lord, I want to come home. I want to be with you. I want to love you. Jesus said, whenever you do this in remembrance of me. And it's a remembrance of the reality that he has come and given his life. And it's the reality of we remember that he's coming again. And he is going to come with power. And it will be a glory that makes the temple look minimal. Because he is the temple himself. Okay? So you guys, take a moment, just a moment to prepare yourself. If there's something you need to put on the table for the Lord, put it out there. 1 John tells us if we confess our sin, he is faithful and righteous to forgive us our sin.